Welcome to another edition of Raging Chicken's Out to Coop Extras. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Today, I'm talking with Chris Robay, author of the new book. Well, it's not exactly brand spanking new, but it is 2017, folks. Breaking the Spell, a history of anarchist filmmakers, videotape guerrillas, and digital ninjas, published by PM Press. Chris is an associate professor in film and media studies at Florida Atlantic University. He's published essays on radical media in journals such as Jump Cut, Rethinking Marxism, and Journal of Film and Video. He's also written the monograph Left of Hollywood, Cinema, Modernism, and the Emergence of U.S. Radical Film Culture. He is also a frequent contributor to the online journal Pop Matters. I had the chance to meet Chris when he swung through Pennsylvania as part of his book tour, and he gave a talk at Kutztown University back on September 14th. And I've got to say, it was one of the coolest talks on media activism, and really activism more broadly, than I've been at in a long time. So with that, welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you.
And then I have to say, it was so great to have you out actually right here on campus at Kutztown University and be part of that talk and actually see some of the video clips that you included as part of your presentation then.
Yeah, I love being there. I have really strong roots in PA because I went to grad school at Lehigh, as you know, so.
Indeed. So it was a bit of a homecoming.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that that's really stuck out to me in your presentation and kind of in your book as is, you know, the focus on these kind of lineages of video activism that goes back to the really, you know, to the 60s or so. But even you can even draw those references that going back even into the 40s, right? When you see these kind of different anarchist tendencies kind of emerge. So before we kind of get into specifics of the book and some of the things you'd like to highlight, how did you get to this project? Like, why end up with anarchist filmmakers and these video guerrillas and digital ninjas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it does go back to the last book I did, the one on deals with 1930s radical film culture. When I was going, and that came out about 2010. So when I was talking to people, you know, going around touring with the book, people were asking, like, what's going on now? And I didn't really know, quite honestly, other than anecdotal stuff. You know, I've been kind of involved here and there with various media activist movements, but nothing really in depth. So I'm a film and media studies scholar. And when I looked to the literature, there wasn't really much being written. There had been good stuff on pockets of stuff, like, you know, from the past about third cinema, anti-colonial film movements in the 60s and 70s. There's been some good stuff written on AIDS activist media in the 80s and 90s. But then when you came to the present, it was only like specific case studies here and there, sporadically done, and mostly in communication studies. So, you know, it kind of became clear there needed to be something, one, that addressed sort of the breadth of what's going on now. And then similarly, because I did a book on the 30s, and part of the argument of that book was, or implicit at least in that book, was a lot of the debates that come up in 1970s left film criticism actually replicate a lot of the issues that come out in the 30s that's been buried under and repressed because many people dismissed the 30s as this vulgar Marxist time that people didn't know, you know, had a really simplistic notion of film and media in general. And really it didn't, right? That book was sort of uncovering of this rich history that was going on that we could have learned from. So I'm very big on like historical lineages between various movements. So, you know, it seemed logical that film is not the big thing nowadays, right, in terms of access, like celluloid.
Right.
Instead, video itself, analog in the early, like late 60s, 70s, and then switching to more digital in the 90s to the present. So one was just to map the terrain of what was going on now. And two, as you mentioned, and I usually do this in most of my talks, is show that lineage, right, that new groups often are sort of in reinventing the wheel, and I wanted them to be aware of kind of the precursors and some of the infrastructure that they were building off of, whether it be conscious or unconscious itself. And with the book too, so I started off in the present and really went backwards writing the book. I did a lot of archival research for the earlier chapters, but I did about over 100 interviews. It's hard to pin down because some were actually taped and some didn't make it into the book and I didn't even record, but just talking to people casually at various events that I was at. The more I told them about the project, and a lot of them were media activists or people who do activism using digital media, were really interested in learning more about this, the other groups that I've been bringing up. So I thought it was really important to tie those things together and focus somewhat on the in-between moments, right? The parts where it's beneath visibility. just to bring it up with the project too, I started in 2009. And if you remember, that was a real low point in terms of activism and particularly media activism. It was the 10-year anniversary of Seattle and everybody was sort of like reflecting on what happened, you know, after such a promise from 99 to about 2003. And, you know, there's a lot of answers that September 11th, right, in many ways came about and activists didn't feel to be as aggressive would be, at least for a brief amount of time, massive repression, extending beyond that on various activist groups from the Bush administration, which is nothing new, I should say, right? Obviously, this extends way back to the government repression of before. But
no, but you know, you make a good point there, though, because, and this is exactly following that lineage, the in-between times, right? Because I remember that distinctly. I mean, I was in Washington, D.C. During the WTO protest and started, was, you know, part of the organizing efforts for the A15, A16 movement with the IMF and World Bank that following spring. And we were gearing up for the second round of major protests when September 11th happened. Mm-hmm. And what always struck me at that, like, one is after September 11th, you know, like, well, there's no way you can move, you can just keep moving forward at this point. Right. But then what happened afterwards, it wasn't as if all those activists went away, right? And I think that's always the way, you know, in part because of necessity, in part because people are trying to make sense of what just happened, right? But it's as if that, you know, these people, this was a movement that stopped and it was just, you know, it popped to the surface, then it was gone. And then, you know, spontaneously later on, more activists did that. When really what was going on is that those activists that were, you know, on the ground, mobilizing, organizing for around global justice issues, kept on doing what they were doing, except it was really much kind of these sideline affairs, which you bring right to the fore.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, so I was at this unique space when I started in 2009 doing these interviews with a lot of people who had been part of the alter globalization movement or other movements itself. And then who would have known, you know, 2011 comes by and the Arab Spring erupts, Occupy Wall Street, all this stuff. And I could see a lot of the people who've been organizing sort of under the radar were involved, like Dave Graber, right, a really clear impetus with Occupy Wall Street and whatnot. So it's sort of exemplified. It's funny, when I started the book, I'm like, oh, well, this will be a history of like sort of past moments in this kind of low, you know, and little did I know it was going to escalate. Now cop watching and stuff like that, you just can't predict. And, you know, the more I learned through interviews and doing archival work, the more I realized the invisible infrastructures that really set up stuff in the present that extend almost all the way back to the 60s, if not before, with a lot of these groups.
Yeah, did you find, I'm curious, because did you find in like specific people that would kind of reemerge over the years? Because that's, you know, one of the things that I find myself stumbling across, people that say we were active with, you know, in the global justice movement. And then, you know, as Occupy Wall Street got gearing up and so on, be down in Philly organizing something, or not even Harrisburg. And I would bump into these people who were kind of like young burgeoning activists, you know, then, right, who were just either entering college or were part of some anarchist communities. And now they're kind of, you know, working on some media project or working with some sort of labor union or something. And it's very interesting to see that these folks have kind of maintained it. You find that too as well?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, certain key figures, and I could just go to the end, you know, mention the end of the book where I end with by Frank Lopez, who is from Puerto Rico and has lived all around. The reason I focused on Frank, other than he does really good work, you know, I think his just an amazing type of media he produces. I disagree somewhat with the politics, but that doesn't matter to me. In some ways, he's doing really interesting stuff, and even the infrastructure he's creating. But he's a good example in terms of how he was involved with a lot of movements. So if you trace his trajectory of his work, you actually trace a lot of movements. He started off in indie media in Atlanta, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, briefly worked as a producer for Democracy Now! Out of New York City. I think a year or two he did that. He then moved to Vancouver in the 2000s, late 2000s, and was part of the Vancouver Media Co-op movement and that whole co-op movement that was occurring. And now he's in Montreal doing sub-media, which has existed all throughout that time, I should say. But he's very involved in the anarchist scene in Montreal. So he has a really interesting trajectory, as well as doing work in Puerto Rico. He keeps going back and visiting and that. So I thought it was a really interesting thread he provided, you know, that weaved together all these various things. And then you have much older activists. I mean, I'm sure you know her, Dee Dee Hallett, right, comes up all the time. She's been involved so long in this stuff. It's such an honor to meet her during conferences and talk to her. But, you know, she's been doing kids films, you know, in other words, having kids film for themselves since the 60s, and had been really involved in the 70s. And obviously her big kind of claim to fame is Paper Tiger Television in the 80s. But, you know, in many ways they helped put together that 5-day program for Seattle, you know, down in Seattle. And she's been involved since, you know, the kind of lesser known project Burn that was going on in UC. I forget where she was, one of the UCs itself. So for sure, you know, there's a lot of people in it for the long haul who kind of are integral in terms of establishing stuff and figuring out and having somewhat critical distance too. You know, they haven't, I mean, it's tough, right? As you know, you've been involved a while. So it's difficult not to become cynical to a certain degree or burnt out or whatnot.
Yeah.
And forget sort of the enthusiasm, you know, that younger people coming to it for the first time have, as well as having that critical distance. I'll just say one of the things I want to do with the book too, and I'm not saying the book's perfect at all by any means. I think it aims big, and if it fails that way, that's okay with me.
Go big or go home, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. So, I mean, if it creates debate, that's fine. You know, I tried the best that I could.
Right.
What I did, but one of my ambitions was to have different generations be dialoguing with one another in the book, because, you know, there are problems on both sides. One, a younger generation, you know, that doesn't really know the past and sort of wants to burn past it, which I get, right? I mean, that's I had that impulse too, you know, of like reinventing and, you know, kind of like out of the fire into new stuff. But
exactly,
there's stuff to be learned from the past, but also older activists who kind of, you know, romanticize the past and don't really want to understand the present and not understand how conditions change and sort of being dismissive to younger people, right? I could see that's a problem too, right? You have to be open. And I feel this myself because I've been involved in this stuff for a while. You have to be kind of receptive to what's going on now. Not accept everything, but at least, you know, hear what people have to say and learn from a younger generation in ways that you haven't. So to foster that, and when I do academic conferences or panels I put together, I try to put together different generations of activists and scholars that perhaps could, like, you know, fuse this kind of dialogue.
No, and I could feel that energy through the book too as well. I mean, we're, you know, it's this balance, even like in your introduction, when you're kind of situating things kind of historically and politically and so on, there's a kind of critical tinge like to it where I can see kind of younger activists kind of getting their backs up a little bit, right? You know, because, you know, the guy talking about the past and looking at the complicated stuff. And like you said, I remember being in that situation of being like, you know, we're going to take the world on, right? And there's nothing going to stop us, and get out of the way, right? And then at the same time, feeling that, you know, the pressure of the older activists kind of like, well, you know, no, we're not going to just romanticize the past, right? And we're not just going to glorify these trajectories that you found yourself in. But, you know, and that is a tough balance, I think, in maintaining and sustaining kind of political movements over time, is where to be able to draw from, you know, the historical legacy of people who've done, say, the practical, you know, like practical training and work and organizing on a daily basis, and learn things about how to do things. But then for those people also to be able to get out of the way, right? To get out of the way for that next generation. And I can't help but kind of situate some of that dynamic within, you know, we saw one of the markers that you lay down is like the 1940s is what happens in anarchist communities, is that there's this break with the labor movement, right? Mm-hmm. The break, move away from labor organizing with attention that's more towards kind of cultural issues. And, you know, I think that for a long time, labor organizing and labor unions had been that historical memory for kind of organization and training and keeping that flame alive. And really, there's been a slow withering of that vine, so to speak. So, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, it was cool to see that thread pull through the book, where, you know, there's going to be people that are going to, I would think at least, kind of get their backs up on some stuff. But it's precisely, I thought, the conversation that has to be had, right? That we have to be able to find room for these historical trajectories and, you know, really the kind of pedagogical aspect of our movements.
Yeah, I mean, I hope people recognize it's a sympathetic critique, you know?
Yes, like, absolutely.
But right, it's not romanticized. And, you know, I have ticked off some people with it, but so be it. You know, like I'm, you know, I tried the best that I could. And obviously, I'll correct any kind of errors that I made. But I'm an organizer, too, right? So, you know, I get the pragmatics of we do need to pump ourselves up and sort of build ourselves up about our movements and celebrate them. But you know, part of the impetus behind the project too, there hadn't been enough critical stuff written, I felt, you know, both about the past or the present. So, you know, you get these idealized moments of, you know, of Seattle, for example, in 1999, you know, thousands of people come with their video cameras and suddenly all this stuff gets shown on the 5-day broadcast, which is far from the truth. And, you know, I guess I see it as a project demystifying, you know, of just saying, okay, well, what exactly happened? What are the logistics that went on? What were the tensions that emerged? We all have them. It's not, you know, here to air dirty laundry, but if you notice throughout the whole book, I try to show consistent issues that come up throughout various movements. Yes. So it's not isolated. So like, you know, gender division of labor comes up, problems of free labor comes up in these things, various race, class, gendered privileges, you know, emerging throughout these things, how to create infrastructure, so on and so forth, you know, in terms of just trying to identify the long struggle and how things keep repeating in many ways and various things. But yeah, you're right. I was really honest when I interviewed people of telling them, like, this is not going to be a celebratory book in terms of what you do, but at the same time, it's not here to air dirty laundry or dismiss. I mean, that's the tricky thing, because when you, some of the people who read it, you know, they see the critique as just totally dismissing everything, and that's not it. You know, no, you can do both. You have your limits, and you can be doing something successfully simultaneously.
Well, it's I don't know if you've read Mark and Paul Engler's book, This Is an Uprising.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it reminds me of a similar point that they try to make in that book too as well, right? I mean, they want to be able to look at something, at practices that work, and kind of that saying, look, there's a way that we can do these things, and it doesn't require us to have some sort of kind of foundational myth, right, that we don't touch, right, that we just kind of make sure that this is the ideal and we're not going to touch this thing, we're not going to be critical of it. No, actually, the critical process is integral to learning about how to be effective. And if the goal is to be effective and to win, right? I mean, this is you know, something that is absolutely important. So that's how I saw the importance of both your talk here and your book, is that kind of contribution to get us actually, you know, okay, let's look at these things kind of in a sober eyes, but like as you said, sympathetically, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because you're not here to discredit these folks, right, as much as you are to say, look, we've got our own kind of lineage here. We've got our own trajectory that we can actually piece together, because look, these stories are not being told. Mm-hmm. And without those stories, I mean, then that negatively affects, I think the movements, but.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, I did this conference in May called the Radical Film Network Conference in New York City, and Chuck Kleinhans did one of the main talks. And I never thought about the book like this, but I think it's somewhat true. He says, you know, we shouldn't just focus on the successes. We also need to focus on the failures. There's things to be learned through that. And I remember, you know, towards the end of the book, when I was dealing with the Canadian media co-op movement, that was when I first started interviewing them in 2009-10, it was on the upsurge, right? It was like really branching out. And then sadly, you know, recently it sort of just disassembled itself and whatnot. So it's kind of sad watching the trajectory upwards and down. With that said, however, you know, there's a lot to be learned in that movement and the ways they were trying to improve off of indie media and do new things. Just because it sort of fell apart doesn't mean it's not a valuable contribution that it did. And some of the people who I spoke to, you know, did later interviews with, follow-ups, who were part of the movement, were happy to have it still in there, you know, and they got it, the sense of tracking this thing that, you know, really sort of had a brief amount of time as the media co-op movement, though it had much longer history with this thing called the Dominion, which still exists. I think that would be a key example, right, of a really ambitious contribution by these activists, many who were part of indie media, learned sort of through the limits and tried something new, and in some ways succeeded, some ways failed. I mean, just because the movement ends doesn't mean it didn't add something throughout it. Not that movements have to last forever, right? You know, so I think that's a really good example of that, of contribution.
Absolutely. So, you know, what are your, to shift gears a little bit here, because like your focus here is on, you know, anarchist or anarchist inflected kind of movements. And so could you talk a little bit about like how you set that up? Why those movements? I mean, I've got, you know, as I was going through it, I'm like, yep. Seems like anarchists are always at the beginning, always in the middle of this, right? But that was kind of an interesting place to begin, right? Or interesting place to follow that thread through. So walk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, one, I didn't know, it's just been invisibilized, right? You know, it's really weird. I study left media activism, and there's been a real resistance, you know, or I don't know resistance, but just sort of not taking into account these new strains. The only example I could think of was John Downing did a book in 1984 called Radical Media that actually does a really good job globally of looking at sort of anarchist practices and media itself. But since then, yeah, people have mentioned here and there, but no kind of through line. And, you know, social movement scholars have been saying this for a while, this kind of anarchist inflected type of new movements occurring during the 50s and 60s and extending onward. So I thought it was really weird that it hadn't been applied to media activism. So just be needed, right? And, you know, when you look there, and, you know, the reason obviously I call it anarchist inflected is because it's like small case A. Right. So some people might self-identify as anarchists and some might not. Some might vehemently not, but nonetheless have some of these aspects within them, as I point out, so non-hierarchical, the attempt to be non-hierarchical, the attempt to do consensus-based decision-making and then direct action, which I just read, actually, L.A. Kaufman's new book, Direct Action, which is amazing. I highly
recommend. I'm like a third of the way through it right now, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a really good companion piece with the thing I wrote. I would try to talk to her and see if we can maybe do something. But anyway, so it's sort of been invisibilized. There's been some resistance by left scholars who I'm good friends with, but nonetheless who are involved with these movements and really, you know, are frustrated with them. So I wanted sort of to give its due, you know, of the broad way in which anarchist practices have kind of influenced. Not that there aren't other forms of video activism, of course there are, but this seemed to be one that was like not really focused on. And then and major movements, you know what I mean? Like AIDS activism, ACT UP in particular, right, was very influenced anarchist-wise. Paper Tiger TV, you know, all these things I kind of focus. Even they were interesting talking to because they would be like, well, we were too busy making a show every week to worry about the philosophy. But nonetheless, yeah, you're right, right? We were doing kind of anarchist-inflected type of activism. So, you know, any kind of book I try to, I didn't want a book to be just a bunch of here's a moment, here's a moment, right. Here's a moment, just right. I wanted there to be through lines throughout it. So one was that notion of anarchist inflected media activism. Two, understanding media activism as a practice, not just only as a thing. And then, as we were talking about before, sort of how does it negotiate the contradictions of capitalism, right? How is it compromised? How is it not? And in some ways, this applies to all of us, right? Not limited to these media activist movements, but in many ways, because they're very dependent on some of the technology, it makes it more to the forefront, this. So yeah, that was it. You know, I just felt it wasn't really focused upon by scholars for whatever reason, you know, the anarchist inflected type of stuff. And the more, you know, I did a lot of participant observation in the book, you know, was part of these actions or, and just know a lot of people who do it. It just seems so present. I mean, it's very obvious to me about Occupy Wall Street, where it wasn't really mentioned in the main press. I mean, obviously among themselves, they knew it, but it's really interesting how it wasn't being translated, you know, as an outgrowth of sort of the alter globalization movement and all these other things. So I thought that was bizarre, you know.
Well, you know, and one of the things that I appreciated so much about kind of your lens, so to speak, for this book is that right from the get-go, I mean, I came up through the kind of anarchist punk scene, right? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of was kind of my, you know, political pedigree, right? You know, I explain to my students all the time is like, you know, punk rock music saved my life. I mean, I was an angry kid, right? And I was mad and I had no idea why, right? You know, I was single, you know, parent family, you know, my sister was mentally handicapped and, you know, we were on food stamps, all this kind of stuff. And then my mom got remarried, all these kind of things that kids go through. And I had all this anger. And then it was punk rock music was the, you know, first time that there was a political language that was put on to help me make sense of kind of what was going on, right? That seemed to pair up with what I was doing. And I was, and it was the political aspect of it. And so one of the things that being part of that, you know, kind of subcultural community coming up is it you see the world through a particular lens. And I saw that like reflected in some of the ways that you characterize what's happening in these filmmakers and the importance of it. It's like, so for example, the stories that I was struck by the one part, where's the, that I wrote this one down to as well. You tell the story about, Well, yeah, it's actually several of them go throughout here, where the critique of the filmmakers, right, or the perspective is not simply just like it's pro versus con, it's good versus evil, but you get a window into the factions on the left, even, right, about some of the disagreements and some of the vibrancy of those discussions, which rarely gets represented in books of history. Like you're talking about that piece, I'm forgetting the title of it now, forgive me, but about Allende, right, mm-hmm. and Chile, right, where you get to see, on the one hand, you know, Allende, for I think most of us who kind of go read about and know anything about Allende, other than he was, you know, overthrown through CIA coup and all that kind of stuff, he's the leftist guy, right? But then you actually see that there's this really dynamic process that's happening at the time. Yeah. And where is that perspective? And I think that what one of the threads that I kept on seeing is precisely that. It's like what it looks like to be within this movement, not simply looking at it from without. And that, I think, alone is so important for the historical record.
Yeah, no, thanks. I'm glad you, yeah, I definitely wanted to accent that. So I think of another more recent example, green anarchism, right? That,
yeah.
You know, anarcho-primitivism or whatever you want to call it. So it gets very, I mean, I'm no anarcho-primitivist, I should be clear. but with that said, there's a bunch of gradations of that within that philosophy. Of course, you might read the stuff that's most publicized in like the journal Green Anarchism. It can be very heavy-handed and whatnot. But once you get into the texture of the movement, it's very variegated. Even somebody like John Zerzan, you know, when you talk to him, is very thoughtful and, you know, self-reflective in ways I would say maybe don't sometimes translate in his writing, which can be a little bit more bombastic. And even people within that movement, you know, we're like, yeah, well, we agree in saving nature. We don't really agree this, you know, smashing of civilization. So even when I went into that, I went to Eugene, I hung out with people there, and it's a really great community to this day still. I mean, it's not obviously as activist as it was, but I went in with a sympathetic thing of like, well, okay, you know, what would make somebody an anarcho-primitivist, right? Like, you know, what is the legitimacy behind this? And I felt I had to go to sort of the old growth forest and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm an avid hiker, an outdoors person. So I could see the appeal, right, in many ways of this. So it was trying to get within those nuances and whatnot with, yeah, it was trying to be both and, you know, like I don't think it's a really viable philosophy or political stance to take, but at the same time, trying to understand the romantic appeal of it. And I don't mean that totally in a negative way, what would be inspirational from it. And also the gradations of it, right? People who might've allied with it or been, you know, supportive members, but not taking the whole pill, right? They see certain aspects of it itself. So I hope that gets relayed in, you know, the way in which I cover this stuff that tries to get at least some of the nuances so it doesn't seem dogmatic or, you know, one thing I realized just along the same lines was, you know, there's one thing that a lot of the journals say that people write, and there's a whole different thing of the oral culture, right, of the way, yes, in which people actually speak on the ground. So that was a good example. If you just went to Green Anarchism, the magazine, it would seem very bombastic and dogmatic and problematic. And I'm not saying that it's not, but once you got on the ground and learned about local actions and the way people were involved, it was much more nuanced and complicated, the way it circulated in people's daily lives.
Absolutely. Was there any like surprises along the way in the research that you came across? You say, wow, I just like either had no idea this ever existed, right? Or that really was an interesting example of you saw something that was innovative or interesting that, you know, just was not on your radar.
A ton, you know,
yeah.
I mean, quite honestly, most of the book was sort of surprised to me. Even things I thought I knew, once you started digging into, you know, you started learning kind of the depth. That's what I do just in general with the book is I interview a ton of people or at least do a lot of archival work on each group. So I kind of dig down, not just across. It doesn't give a, you know, I want to get into the practices of what people did and sort of the textures of that moment or the moments that they might have been a part of. So, yeah, there was so much that I learned through the book. I'll just say this. This is the big one. Like, I'm much more sympathetic to anarchism than I was, quite honestly, just because I was learning while doing the book of its various gradations, mm-hmm. and certain legitimate practices that it has, you know, once again, sort of the small case A anarchism, how I maybe integrate practices of that even in my own union and activist struggles. So it's funny. People often assume if they don't know me, you know, I'm an anarchist, which I'm not. because I wrote the book, but I strangely get very defensive because I do feel what anarchists are going through when I present the book, and people are like, oh yeah, anarchists don't believe in structure and this and that. And I'm like, well, that's, Like that's pretty offensive. I mean, it's like saying feminists just believe this or Marxists just believe that, but somehow you can wield this on anarchists. So I'm often defensive that way. Like, well, no, there's loads of different types of variations of this. And depending on scale and historical conditions, it can be really legit and useful, you know? So,
well, you know, I the example I always give, you know, when people say, I said, well, you know, it was funny because when I was in with, you know, my anarchist punk scene, right, we built more things, like put out more newsletters, had more institutions for musics and shows and culture than people are doing here at my university. So I don't know what you're talking about. Like, you know, and again, it was always that same kind of tension. Like on the one hand, you don't see the culture that you want, so you're just going to just do it. You're going to build it, right? And there's that vibrancy to it, right? And at the same time, you know, the distancing or the distrust of structure makes it difficult to sustain some of those things over a period of time. But it's never as, you know, again, never as black and white as it's ever presented. So what I thought we could do is let's take a little bit of a break and then we'll come back. And I'd like to kind of bring us in here to Pennsylvania, because one of the places that you highlight in here is the Media Mobilizing Project. And like you said, also you're spend some time here in Pennsylvania, right? You got this like nice roots here. So I thought we could come back and talk about that. But before we go to breaks, so I want everybody know that we're going to run a special on this through December, right? So as you're doing your Christmas shopping, right? Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for at the $10 a month level, and we will send you a copy of Chris's book, okay? And so we want to get this out to as many people as possible, right? And we also want to create a sustainable media environment right here at Raging Chicken Press. So I just want to give that shout out keep on looking for it, because we're going to push it on Facebook. It's an awesome book. So we're going to come back right after this. And when we do, we're going to get into some PA local stuff, folks. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, talking with Chris Robay about breaking the spell. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive, activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken Out to Coop Extra. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. I'm here once again with Chris Robay talking about his book, his new book, Breaking the Spell, A History of Anarchist Filmmakers, Videotape Guerrillas, and Digital Ninjas. So before we let Chris go, I wanted to bring it back to Pennsylvania here because, like as you said, on the one hand, you've got some roots here in Pennsylvania, but also you've got, you did some work in this book on some folks doing some really interesting work here on the ground in terms of media mobilizing, the media mobilizing project. But I think, you know, you're talking about that not just in terms of producing of the videos, but also this community-based sharing of skills, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. So take us into that.
Yeah. So first of all, I should give credit. A lot of the stuff I wrote in Breaking the Spell, I co-authored with Todd Wolfson and Peter Funke. Todd's one of the founders of Media Mobilizing Project. And I can kind of go in just the background, which I don't mention in the book. I met Todd back in 2010 at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, which I can't remember exactly how we met, but somehow online we heard about each other's work and, you know, met there and got along and have really kind of similar outlooks, quite honestly. And we're both from the East Coast, roughly the same age, blah, 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 all that. So, you know, long story short, after I got to know Todd and we did a couple conferences together, he gave me access to Media Mobilizing Project. I mean, I wanted to interview or whatnot. This was still in the early days, so like 2009, 10, 11 with it. So it was really great to be able to talk to a lot of the workers who were part of the project itself. I think, you know, once again, similarly, Todd and I kind of come out of the indie media movement, you know. I wasn't really directly involved with much of that stuff, but I was following it pretty adamantly. He'd been involved with Philly indie media itself, which is sort of a precursor somewhat to Media Mobilizing Project. And we were both kind of frustrated sort of, and to be honest, to this day with a lot of the various movements of sort of the lack of class consciousness, you know, sort of what's going on, which I should say, I'm not bringing up a Bernie Sanders-ish, you know, identity politics. I don't believe, right, you can have both simultaneously, right? There are sophisticated things that put it out really clearly. I believe in identity politics in a sophisticated way that tie with class and whatnot. So I'm not, it's not an either or. Put it down, you know? Because people sometimes interpret it that way, and I don't want to see.
No, no, and a totally aside, and you can see how easy that is right now if you just follow the, with the release of Donna Brazile's book about how quickly things went in that direction, right? And there's like no space in between, but
right.
But and anyways,
it is. The best movements do it, you know. Right. So anyway, there's a frustration, you know, sort of with indie media that there was, you know, it's largely white, upper middle class kids, college educated, who are doing it. And once again, which isn't a problem necessarily, but to make it a more broad-based movement, it is, right? There's a lot of infrastructure and privilege that other people don't have, historically disenfranchised communities. So, you know, Media Mobilizing became a really interesting example, first of all, of coming out of two earlier movements, and I'm sure more, but what Todd and others who founded the movement triggered it as is one was indie media and Philly, which actually should be written about. I keep trying to encourage Todd to write about this of Philly indie media and sort of it's more focused on class than some of the other chapters and the labor
movement. It was always notable for that. And especially, you know, as Philly's got one of those long established anarchist communities that has, you know, go through fits and starts, but you know, you've got a long, long history of that kind of political engagement and overlaps with, you know, with some of the labor folks there.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. The other side's the labor movement too, right? Jobs for Justice and stuff like that. Both of these, you know, the people who founded Media Mobilizing had been a part of and had sort of their frustrations with. So, you know, they wanted to create this greater metro area organization that could assist working class people with their struggles for whatever it might be, higher wages, unionization, access to school. They work with a lot of Temple students. But I should say, what made them good is that many of them live there. They had already fostered relationships with some movements. They weren't just like suddenly creating an organization and going out like, well, let's help working class folk, you know? Like it was actually dialogue going on prior to that. And I like the whole, they needed to build the new leadership out of the people who they brought on. So there's always this intention of Media Mobilizing Project for the founders to sort of move aside and actually have working class folk themselves be the engine that drives the organization, which I can happily say is sort of, you know, it's come to fruition, that it's been really successful in that way. At the same time, I'll say, you know, I highlight this in a lot of the various movements of the present, that to create sort of movements that connect with working class people of color or historically disenfranchised communities, often you still need some kind of middle class, what would you call it, ballast, you know? So, you know, a lot of the founders were in grad school, came from middle class backgrounds, or in undergrad. It's pretty diverse racially speaking and gender, but nonetheless class-wise, it was very heavily loaded to middle to upper class folk itself, which is nothing to take away from the organization, just shows sort of how these alliances need to happen to do it. Another interesting organization that I speak about too is Voice Mob out of LA that similarly had an allyship with the USC Annenberg to create this thing for Latino day laborers, you know, of documenting their struggles and their lives and whatnot. So I see those as very kind of linked kind of organizations. They know of each other and whatnot. So media mobilizing, yeah, they saw, you know, the media making as an outgrowth of the struggles itself. And similarly with the book, that new media speaks to legacy media, right? They're incorporating all these things together. So with Media Mobilizing Project, and particularly I focus on the cab driver's struggle for a union, which they do get, you know, the first thing that they really do is establish a radio show, which makes sense because right. they're in their cabs all day,
yeah.
right? All day long for it. And one thing I would even critique the book for, I don't deal with radio enough because that really is, in many ways, still the most accessible of all, you know, electronic media out there itself. So, you know, I really wanted to focus on the multiple ways in which they were using media in Media Mobilizing Project. And one of the central arguments of this section on them is, you know, with a neoliberal world, right, where the workplace is increasingly broken up, either through digital communication, like where we teach, you know, people are doing online or whatnot, right. or a service-based economy where you're getting commissions and stuff and you see yourself as the enemy, your fellow worker, right? Cab drivers is a very isolating position because your fellow cab drivers are competing for the very funds that are going to like go to your family. So it's hard to organize them, you know, right. together because they see each other logically as competition. That's the way the job's set up. So sort of, you know, my Todd and Peter's argument and sort of my bigger argument of the book is, well, how can we use media making or how can these organizations use media making as a new place where people can congregate and form their own kind of self-consciousness, self-determination and whatnot, forge these things even before making it, right? Like getting people together in the same room to discuss, you know, their struggles and realize that their own individual hardship is linked to other people's, right? I mean, this is like 101 consciousness raising, right?
Bingo. Yep.
Is really important. So that's the other thing too, you know, in the chapters I write, I don't want to fetishize the media, right? In many ways, it's a process of this longer struggles and it's not an end point, but a means towards it. And that sort of just goes back to the beginning of the book where I focus on Third Cinema that similarly had a view of the films they were making as not endpoints, but actually a catalyst in the struggle.
Yeah, for, I mean, I love how you said that, like, you know, again, towards the beginning when you're talking about how, you know, the product, the actual videotape itself was not necessarily the end goal. It was the distribution. It was the talking about it. It was the gathering together. Mm-hmm. And with Media Mobilizing Project, you know, you see this at the level of production too as well, with actually thinking about the crafting of the narratives themselves, which I've always, when I first came across them, I was really taken back with what they were able to do and how they envisioned what their purpose was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of constant investment, the crafting of the narrative of solidarity, right? I mean, as you say, kind of frequently, you know, as with the advance of, you know, neoliberalism and so on, we become more and more isolated, pitted against one another. We're encouraged to, you know, join the sharing economy and like, you know, work for free everywhere you go, right? As if everything else was, and how do you actually find each other in the midst of that? And, you know, again, there's a rich history of this. You know, there's a rich history of media being one of these places where people find to gather, right? At different stages of, especially kind of, you know, economic upheaval, places where, you know, suddenly we need to kind of remake our culture to correspond to the way that the world works, and defining these spaces in media and to see it actually at the level of production too as well, I think was so critical, right? To be able to say that this is a means by which we can actually craft an organization and a vision that we're doing this together and represent ourselves, right? Represent our story kind of unfiltered with at the same time it's not just being shown just for ourselves, right? That we kind of envision a wider impact to as well.
Yeah, and one thing, you know, I try to make a point in the book, it's like as you point out, right, there's nothing new of using media for organizing, right? It's been done in the most successful labor campaigns, it was being done, you know, in the 40s. Lenin was advocating the importance of a newspaper, right, for distribution and connection. You can go back, you know, Thomas Paine and Common Sense, right,
right.
As a form of mobilizing. My big argument in the book is what's changed is the accessibility to this, right, and people, particularly in privileged sectors of the West and whatnot. So quantitatively, it qualitatively changes it, right, because of this, it becomes more integral to these practices. And in light of a more neoliberal world where physical space is being dissolved and privatized and less access, that the focus of making media, whatever it might be, print, legacy, you know, or video or whatnot, provides a commonality and a common space, you know, commons, right? Quite honestly, that's absent, that becomes more vital. You know, even as an organizer myself, I feel like physical presence has more weight now than it did in the past because it was more common, you know, in the past of either on the shop floor or wherever you might have been. Now it's much harder to congregate people together, particularly at a university where you have people adjuncting and traveling around. So to provide that space and actually outside of the university where people can talk freely about their things is really, you learn a lot, right? I mean, a lot of work gets done when you just get a bunch of people together in a room talking about and carve out about an hour or two to talk about stuff. It's amazing. I've seen it myself in my own kind of organizing campaigns and recognize it elsewhere. So I think, you know, the practice hasn't changed, but the context has, and it's sort of made it even more radicalized to some degree when it happens.
Yeah, very much so. And one of the things that we can see is, like, you know, it's always been touted as one of the possibilities of the internet and the digital age and things like this, is that it makes actually the tools of crafting this stuff kind of somewhat more accessible than it was when you're dropping like $2,000 for a camera or something like this for video activism in particular. But again, I think that the technology itself is not what makes this, right? Which again was why the highlight on the practices, the highlight on kind of the initiative and the history of these organizations, which I find so critical. So,
yeah, I mean, I'll just say too, the book was a trick too, because, you know, if there's two spectrum ends of it, you know, one is this process oriented stuff that I would say media mobilizing is more a part of, but I also wanted to address the other end, the people who are self-defined artists, you know, who are documentary filmmakers and whatnot, who are shaping the craft, people like Dave Martinez or Frank Lopez, along those lines, to kind of, because it's funny, on the opposite end, people who I know are media makers, some have objection of like calling themselves video activists because they think of any fool with a camera, you know.
right.
I mean, they worked really hard and I get it, but, you know, I needed some blanket term somewhat that would incorporate all this in. So it's, you know, both trying to, you know, acknowledge the practices and the processes, as well as acknowledging people who are forging kind of new type of aesthetics and objects. And even with the process oriented stuff, to do close analysis of all this, like what, you know, what political implications do various aesthetics have and form and stuff like that. I felt just, that was the other thing I felt that the book hopefully added in communication studies. There's a lot of talk about some of these movements, but there's no analysis or very little analysis of the form. Right? They'll sometimes talk about what's being said, but you don't get a sense of the texture of like it being video or online or whatnot. So I try to get a sense of specificity. That's my background as a media studies scholar, to actually get into the nuances. Because, I mean, ideally, the videos, at least the more professionally done ones, are supposed to be inspirational, right? There's a reason to create an affect and whatnot. So I wanted to get a sense of how it creates a vibrant sense. There's a reason why Frank Lopez's stuff is popular, right? Because he's many ways, you know, took a culture jamming approach in a really effective anarchist direction, you know, in a really slick style, smart dialogue and all that. So I think that should be given its due. You know, one thing that was frustrating me when I would go to some media activist conferences is form really wasn't spoken about much at all. And I was just like, well, you know, what's up? And when I talk to media makers, they'd be frustrated, you know, people who are documentary filmmakers with it. So it's weird that I feel like there's still no space. I mean, I hope somebody can let me know. I'd love to go to a conference where actually form is discussed, other than, you know, sort of in break off circles, because it feels it's sort of absent, right? It's just a lot of just talking in generalities. You know, we're going to live stream this or whatever.
No, exactly. Because I mean, this is the other side of the, you know, I come out of rhetorical studies, right? And this is one of the, and you know, we do activist writing media stuff. Another class in rhetoric, democracy, advocacy. And one of the things, and kind of the way I come at a lot of this stuff too, as well, you see, when you're talking about like advocacy work, right? When you're talking about kind of making cases and so on, it's not as if just like saying the facts or saying the platform or saying the thing is what makes it effective, right? You have to really look at, you know, the moves that are being made, the things that are appealing, and what makes one thing effective and something else a piece of garbage, right? That goes nowhere or actually can be detrimental to what you're doing. So absolutely. I hear that. Echo that 100 times. But
yeah, my thing is always just like, well, what's the intent of it? You know, in other words, we shouldn't critique process oriented stuff for not living up to the standards of product oriented, right?
Right.
And vice versa. Like there needs to be a certain awareness of the context of these things being used. And I try to do that within the book. I'm not going to critique, you know, process oriented stuff of like having lousy voiceover. You hear the sound of wind blowing into the microphone. Like, right? The point is just getting people. One thing I learned in going back to media mobilizing, particularly dealing with like working class populations, the difficulty for them is not, you know, obviously even having access to the media or editing it. One is obviously having time. You're working so much, you know, two or three jobs. But even more importantly, it's psychological. Like, believe your voice matters, that you can collectively do something together. That's the real hurdle, right? After years of education that kind of trains you to be docile and just follow rules, listen to the bell go off, you know, from here. If you think how dysfunctional K-12 is in treating students, it's so inhumane. Why bells would ring and move people from class to class?
Train them for the factory, man. Train them for the factory.
Yeah, right. To get over that hurdle is really massive. So a lot of people I would speak to from media mobilizing would say, if you interviewed me like a year or two ago, I would not have spoken to you for various reasons. One, I wouldn't have felt my voice mattered. Two, I've been afraid my boss would have heard this stuff, you know, and retaliated against me. So it's a really major thing of, you know, letting people recognize their own voice and the validity of that, and other people should listen to it, and actually change can emerge if you kind of collectively get together and do that. It's major.
Absolutely. I'm struck by those last thing, and then I have one more question for you. But you know, I remember the film that you showed that illustrated that so much, is when you have the young white kid, right, going up and interviewing these two African American workers, and he said at first time, I can't remember the name of the film or the group that he was with at that time, but that you showed this clip when you're at Kutztown, and at first those workers being very reluctant to say anything, but then as he just sat there, and again, the frame is, you know, this head's off to one side at one point and all that kind of stuff. But as that goes on, this guy has got so much to say, which is, again, what you want, right? Where voice matters.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's Interview in the Streets by the Video Freak. So yeah, very kind of not known, you know, title. But that's what it was, right? You know, just getting out there and sort of getting a sense of people do have knowledge, right? People do have understandings of things. We need to recognize that and provide. And the good thing about video, because you're not burning through film and worried about how much it costs, it can provide the time to record that, because you're not pressing people to give an immediate, like, you know, two word response or whatnot. You're letting the moment unfold somewhat, though clearly the camera does interject and affect it, but nonetheless allow this to emerge. That's why I show that clip, because the person initially, you know, he's a construction worker, black construction worker, who's like, well, I have nothing to say on this. And then when the camera just rolls a little more, he actually has a lot to say and thought a lot about that issue.
Absolutely. Well, so let me ask you this now. I mean, this is kind of outside of the scope of your book, but I mean, you know, since this book comes out, and we've got Trump, right, sitting in the White House, we've got whole new sets of challenges. And I'm just curious if there's things that you're seeing emerging at all that are kind of interesting on the kind of like on the media front, where people are attempting to do interesting things now and kind of picking up this mantle that you kind of see, or this legacy in some ways that you see in your book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm continuing with a new book on state repression, video activism, and counter surveillance. So it deals with cop watching, the environmental movement, dealing with ag gag laws that try to prevent you from filming animal cruelty, making the filming of it illegal, not the cruelty, the repression against counter summit protesting and video activism, and then finally, Muslim American surveillance on social media and offline, and the resistance to that. So anyway, a lot of these groups that I've been interviewing for that and had interviewed for the book obviously are recalibrating in many ways to address Trump with what's going on. So particularly, there's a couple of Latino groups Puerto Rican, actually, out of New York City, that I've been, you know, talking with and part of for about 2 years for the new work. But they've been kind of redirecting their energies towards deportations and stuff like that. Similarly with the hurricanes, interesting enough with them, with Puerto Rico, they're kind of redeflecting stuff. That the big thing I didn't anticipate is this Antifa stuff, you know,
right,
going on now. So I think that'll be a part of the new book itself in terms of just Antifa's and white nationalism, particularly white nationalism's connection to the police and the longer legacies of that, which we saw in Charlottesville. I mean, I'm listening to these horrifying stories of groups like Unicorn Riot and It's Going Down and stuff like that, who'd been there filming and really revealing a lot more than was revealed the commercial media. Even in terms of, if you think of Charlottesville, the narrative by the commercial media was like, oh, these are, you know, anti-fascist protesters versus, you know, these white nationalists. No mention goes with the police sort of implicitly allying themselves with the nationalists, or even the historical legacy of the South and the police, or the police in general, right, and sort of racist practices itself, which is apparent to anybody who kind of seen this. So, you know, it's really uncertain times, because a lot of the groups have been focused really locally. I'm thinking New York City, that was particularly focusing on de Blasio's notion of affordable housing, you know, right, and kind of had a really good front. And they're still focusing on that. With Trump in office, I think the focus has gotten broader in many ways. So I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to be open. You know, I feel like it's too new somewhat. I mean, the J20 thing is really disturbing in many ways, right? In that the way we wanted to requisition information from the website about who was participating on that itself. So
yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating. I mean, I can't wait to see what you do with it. I mean, especially because I think about, you know, just the development of kind of like the whole kind of neo-fascist, neo-Nazi, alt-right, whatever we want to put on them, that whole, their use of, say, video media, YouTube, Twitter, and like the whole meme culture is just, I've gone down that hole a few times now, just to kind of wrap my head around kind of how that's working on that end. And that's just fascinating stuff.
It's really crazy, right? I mean, I agree. And if anything, you know, people ask about the book I wrote, you know, not dealing with the right wing. And I'm like, well, in some ways, the left has often been more grassroots and at the forefront of this type of stuff. But yeah, right now, particularly, not that I like Vice at all, Vice News, but occasionally they nonetheless get access to things that are pretty interesting. So they had an interesting piece on Charlottesville. When you listen to these white nationalists speak, they're actually sounding the very vocabulary that we use. Meme, you know, grassroots organizing. Like, it's really disturbing the way in which it's pushed to the forefront in a way that I haven't heard before. Not that I haven't tried before, but it seems very pronounced now. Now, who knows if they're going to be successful? I mean, it seems, at least knock on wood, Charlottesville was this blip that they created of media, but everything else has sort of faltered, right? They haven't had that kind of turnout with other kind of rallies that they've had. But nonetheless, you're right. I mean, the way in which these things are being appropriated by the right, which the right always does, but I just haven't heard it to this extent or that concentration, that Charlottesville in particular. I was just like, because I was following Antifa, but I'm like, I don't know if I want to write on this or, but Charlottesville sort of like was like, okay, this is pretty serious.
Yeah, well, fantastic stuff. Well, again, Chris, man, thanks so much for taking the time today to kind of hang out with us here. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And a reminder, this is Breaking the Spell, A History of Anarchist Filmmakers, Videotape Guerrillas, and Digital Ninjas. And if you want your very own copy of this, right, become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $10 a month. You know, you can come in higher. I'm not going to be upset with you. And we'll send you a book. We'll send you the book as a huge thank you, and to get the word out to about this. You know, I think it's really important, especially right now, as so many people have been trying to figure out what the hell to do, right, in this age of Trump, and how to actually think about sustained activism. It's not just one event right now, right? People are having to think about the long haul. And this is one of these times where we need to be reading stuff like this, to be think about our own histories and legacies, to learn from us, to better position us, to kind of, you know, organize better, mobilize better, right, and produce the kind of media that we need for the movements to be successful. So thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We are out of here. See ya.
Thank you.